This podcast was recorded on the lands of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders past and present and recognise their continuous connection to culture. We would also like to thank the people of Norfolk Island, Aotearoa New Zealand and the Pacific for allowing their stories to be told. July 25, 1985. 15 days have passed since the Rainbow Warrior bombing. 9 since the French secret agents sailed into darkness from Norfolk Island. 19-year-old Kiwi Air Force mechanic Don Sims rocks up for work at Auckland's Whenuapai base feeling extra pumped up. He's off fixing helicopter engines today. He's going on maritime patrol in the P3K Orion, a four-propeller engine, long-range surveillance plane.
The Orion was always an aircraft I was interested in. I'd done a school project on it in my last year of high school.
This patrol's intended to be a day trip over New Zealand's fisheries zone.
I got in my flying overalls and we started briefing for a normal maritime patrol around the coast. And then all of a sudden it changed and they said, oh, we're not going to do that anymore. Do you have a passport? And I says, yep. And the crew said, go and get it and get an overnight bag because we're probably going to be staying somewhere overnight. And at that stage, I don't think I knew what we were looking for or what we're doing, but it sounded exciting.
This is going to be no ordinary patrol.
And then eventually we briefed to do a search for the Uvea.
This is Fallout, spies on Norfolk Island.
Watch them from the wharf. We all knew that this is the last we're going to see of them and that yacht, and they couldn't get out of there quick enough. I don't think that they truly believed that they were being let go as well.
I think you've been telling me lies.
No.
What happened the day you went to Auckland?
I have told you.
We needed time, and time wasn't our friend.
Episode 4. Damage containment. Don's unexpected mission is the result of some huge developments in the Rainbow Warrior investigation. 2 days earlier, on July 23, Kiwi Detective Maurice Witham and his crew landed a big blow on French agents Alain Maffar and Dominique Prieur, who were posing as the Swiss honeymooning couple, the Taronges.
Charged them with the murder, conspiracy to blow up the ship and blowing up the ship as part of the conspiracy.
And on the day Don Sims is up in the Orion searching the vast Pacific Ocean for the Uvea, Kiwi police issue warrants for the arrest of Verge, Bartolo and Andres on the suspicion of murder and arson. As we know, there was reasonable circumstantial evidence already connecting them to the Rainbow Warrior sabotage found while they were in Australian custody on Norfolk Island. Receipts for items linked to the crime, maps placing them at key locations, suspicious diving gear, and photos of a rubber zodiac similar to the one used in the attack. But they were let go. A bad mistake. In the days after they sailed away, confirmation of their involvement came in. There were traces of explosives found in the Uvea's bilge and documents connecting them to other French agents. Maurice tells me about yet another piece in the puzzle connecting the Uvea crew to the bombing.
And this is typically New Zealand. We had a lot of cooperation from the public.
On the night the Rainbow Warrior was bombed, some fishermen noticed a Zodiac rubber boat with an outboard motor coming close to the shore. Whoever was driving it was pissing them off because they were coming too close to their fishing spot.
And they were throwing sinkers at him because he was disturbing the fish with this little pop-up motor going in. And then he went under the bridge.
The fishermen lost sight of the Zodiac, but two cyclists going over the bridge picked up the trail.
And as they're cycling over the bridge, they see this little grey Zodiac and a little outboard motor, blue with a red and white stripe. And they heard this thing putting under the bridge, and then they heard a splash. There was no noise. And they saw a man with some oars paddling inside the marina.
By this stage, the police had already found the Zodiac boat, but its motor was still missing. Morris sent police divers back into the water to take another look, using information from the fishermen and the cyclists.
Sure enough, the diver came back and found this outboard motor. It was just by the pier. It still had the serial number on it. The motor was about 3 years old, so we did some inquiries with Yamaha in Japan. They said it had been sold to a company in London called Barnett Marine.
Police had also tracked down the Commodore station wagon the Uvea crew used while they were in New Zealand. They inspected every inch of the car and found something very interesting.
If you open the back door of the station wagon, just on the left-hand side where the struts come down to the vehicle itself, there was just a faint three lines of very, very faint blue paint, and they matched that paint to the Yamaha identical paint. So the motor that was found in Okahu Bay had been in the back of that station wagon. And that station wagon was rented to the Ovea crew.
The upshot was that by July 25, 1985, there's no doubt Verge, Bartolow and Andries were complicit in an act that killed an innocent man. But police have no idea where they are. Kiwi cops have been searching in vain for them for 4 days on land in New Caledonia. The best bet is they're out there, somewhere, on the world's biggest ocean. Countries New Zealand believed were its friends were offering no help. Retired detective Morris Witham.
We checked with everybody, and the Americans in particular, to give us a location of the Ovea, and we were told that there was no way they could track the Ovea.
Morris still has his doubts about this, believing the satellite navigation equipment on board the Frenchman's yacht would have made it easier to find. But as mentioned by Kiwi journalist Nikki Hager, the Americans had cut off New Zealand from crucial satellite imaging in response to the country's ban on nuclear-armed ships docking in its ports.
Even the British were very reluctant to assist in any way.
New Zealand's only hope was to put up its most sophisticated surveillance plane, Air Force mechanic Don Sims.
Did a high-level transit to Norfolk Island and then descended and then flew from Norfolk towards New Caledonia at low level, about 200 feet. I remember the brief from the crew was any radar contacts on that track, we would go and investigate and look at it.
The police photographer who'd snapped the yacht on Norfolk Island is also on the flight. He's passing around photos of the Uvea.
I knew what we were looking for.
As the Orion nears New Caledonia, a French territory with thousands of French troops, things grow more tense.
The crew sort of were being a bit sheepish, I guess, about their intentions. And then we were flying past, I remember, lots of islands. I was manning one of the observation windows, the big bubble windows that everyone, yeah, they do a visual search as well as the radar search. I remember they talked about they wanted to go to this island called Uvea. There was an island in New Caledonia north of the main island called Uvea, and they thought maybe the yacht's gone to its own island. So they headed towards that, and I can remember we were quite close to land, which I assume would be parts of New Caledonia territory. The next thing, we flew over a Navy patrol boat. So we were busted.
While all of this is going on, back in Wellington, New Zealand's most senior intelligence and defence officials are meeting for a status update on the Rainbow Warrior case. The spooks tell the Air Force men that the Orion crew should also be keeping an eye out for a French nuclear-powered submarine that's reportedly in the area.
We just carried on and kept searching. In the end, it got dark. We then flew to Fiji and stayed the night. Total flight time, just over 9.5 hours, I think.
While the flight crew sleeps, Don and a fireman from his Air Force base, who's also been selected for the patrol, are told to guard the Orion.
So the P3 Orion had a lot of sophisticated anti-submarine warfare and radar technology on it. So wherever they overnighted a non-military airport, they always just have to guard the aircraft.
The plane heads out again the next day. Don's not on board this time. He's catching up on sleep. The Orion returns after more fruitless hours above the ocean.
they'd found a life raft on that second patrol that I wasn't on, but whether it was from the Avia or just a life raft that was floating around the ocean.
But no sign of the yacht or its crew. 40 years later, there's still no conclusive answer about what happened to the Uvea. It's never been found. Don Sims recounts the theory New Zealand police and intelligence officials believe the most likely.
The Uvea rendezvoused with a French submarine. They took the guys off the boat and then scuttled the ship.
David Robey, the Kiwi journalist who became a de facto Rainbow Warrior crew member in 1985, remembers the commander of France's Pacific Forces doing a radio interview in Tahiti at the time the Uvea disappeared.
And they said, "Admiral, when a boat sinks in the middle of the Pacific, the crew have to swim. Where did they swim to?" And Admiral Huygens, he replied, "Some sailors are excellent swimmers."
No doubt the Admiral had a raised eyebrow while making that statement. The last anyone heard or saw of the Uvea before it disappeared was a radio message. Maurice Witham.
And we heard a radio transmission from the Uvea to a place in Paris or in France saying that they'd caught a cold in Norfolk Island and they needed assistance. We assumed that that was, you know, indicative of we've run into trouble.
The murder charges and arrest warrants against the DGSE agents sent a shockwave through the then French president François Mitterrand's government. France has strenuously denied any involvement in the attack on the Rainbow Warrior, while pointing the finger at other countries.
But within weeks, this position is no longer plausible, thanks to the information coming from members of the New Zealand public and the detective work by Kiwi police.
Mitterrand's left with no option but to do what all politicians do when faced with a crisis, hold an inquiry. On August 8, 1985, the French government appointed respected public servant Bernard Tricot to head an investigation into the Rainbow Warrior affair.
Nous reviendrons dans un instant avec Bernard Tricot, qui est notre invité, et j'ai plusieurs questions précises à vous poser, Monsieur Tricot. Mais d'abord, le détail de notre rapport avec Françoise Champey.
As chief of staff during the presidency of France's World War II hero, General Charles de Gaulle, Tricot had gravitas. Morris tells me that this was a particularly unsettling time for the New Zealand police officers they'd sent to Paris to work on the Rainbow Warrior investigation. He remembers the cooperation from the French police as being pretty good at the start.
When the guys were in France, they were going out assisting with inquiries, for instance, and our guys got assigned an office and they put us into a hotel where it was handy for our guys to stay.
But the more the Kiwi police unearthed to reveal the ugly truth, the more difficult things in Paris became.
We just heard 8:30 and we head off, and so they go there, 8:30. No one around. Where's the guys gone? Oh, no, they left at 8. So they went without our guys on the inquiry.
And they felt like they were being followed as they chased leads. Like this unusual job, where a Kiwi officer in Paris was tasked with finding a match for a piece of women's clothing found on some diving equipment in the harbour.
His job was to go in and buy pantyhose from women's hosiery shops. And we were sure, that guys were sure that they were being followed. And here's this kinky New Zealand police officer buying these grandma lap pantyhose. And we bought back about, 20 pair of pantyhose. We sent them to Canterbury Hosiery in Christchurch. And they matched the pantyhose that were on the one of this oxygen bottle. They matched it with a pantyhose that this guy had bought. The pantyhose was produced on a pre-1945 machine of a Repetto make, and they were never exported.
There was one sympathetic Parisian policeman who had a suggestion for his Kiwi guests amid the rising tension.
I would get out of that hotel room. And no reason was given.
Do you think the warning from the French officer to not stay in that room was about that room's compromised?
Of course. So our guys moved closer to our embassy, and the people that were working with them, liaising with them, were really annoyed. Why did you change hotels? Wasn't it good enough? What's wrong with the room you had?
And that office they'd been given to work from?
Oh, no, we need the office back.
At least the Kiwi cops still had the special James Bond telephone that New Zealand spy agency has kitted them out with.
And this great phone was a massive great thing, this big shoe phone, 10-digit coding on it to talk, and it was like a radio telephone over, and it was they'd speak and we'd speak. And it was highly encrypted, and you couldn't bust the encryption up because we didn't want our communications to be intercepted. So that's the level of paranoia there was.
While all this is happening, Chris Masters, one of Australia's premier investigative journalists of the past 50 years, is crisscrossing the South Pacific and hitting the streets of Paris, conducting his own inquiry. Journalistic instinct tells him and ABC Four Corners executive producer, Peter Manning, to get to Auckland soon after the Rainbow Warrior was sunk. There might be a story behind it. But Chris's initial expectations are low.
Obviously, I was a little bit interested, but I do remember back at the time, people were saying things like lone wolf, angry Vietnam vet. People weren't saying, you know, a massive conspiracy, a state-run spy operation.
Within days, Chris senses a change of energy among the Kiwi police.
Those atmospherics became alive to a point where a couple of days in, I was having a conversation with the head of the New Zealand police force running the investigation at the time. And the local journalists called him Lockjaw. I think his name was Galbraith. It was a Scot. But he said nothing. He was very professional. He wouldn't sort of disclose anything to the media. And I was sitting there talking to him and I said, do you know what? I think the French Secret Service is behind this. And he just gave me a look. That was all. No words. But that look said to me, I was right.
For any aspiring journalist listening, pay attention to what Chris says next.
That's been a big lesson for me in journalism because I think of it all the time. You know, like you don't get that look if you're working, Googling or, you know, even if you're on the telephone. Being there was really important.
A major focus for Chris is tracing the movements of the Uvea crew. This is a sample from his 1985 French Connections report.
On the day after the French woman left New Zealand, a French man calling himself Raymond Robert Welch arrived in Umea, also apparently on a reconnaissance mission. He test sails a yacht here at Umea Yacht Charters and spends a week preparing for a sailing holiday before flying back to Paris. While the man calling himself Welch is believed to be still in Umea, another Frenchman makes a £1,400 purchase here in London.
Chris joins the quest to find the Frenchman and their yacht.
No point in going to Norfolk Island because the Avaya had already left, but we were on the phone to people. I was lucky I knew a school teacher there. I gave her a call and she put me in touch with a bunch of people and they told me quite a lot. We knew the Avaya had departed. I got on the phone to Peter Manning, my boss back in Sydney, and said, we need to go to Umea. So we changed planes at Sydney Airport and headed there to a fairly hostile reception that the New Zealanders got used to after a while. And there were New Zealand police there as well, and they were treated very much the same way as we were. You know, this there wasn't a lot of room for investigative journalism or cooperation with the public.
A senior New Caledonia politician tells Chris,
I think it's ridiculous to accuse either France or New Caledonia.
While the police and Air Force Maritime Patrol have no luck finding the Uvea, Chris and producer Bruce Belsham strike gold
by asking a favour from the people manning New Caledonia's radio transmitter to connect them to the crew on the boat.
I remember getting the radio link and organising a radio call to them. Bruce and I had only schoolboy French, so, you know, we weren't that confident about conversing. So we organised a translator to come along, and the call came through and the translator wasn't there. So we struggled mightily with our appalling French, and then that call just stopped in mid-sentence.
Do you think with your communication with the yacht, do you think it was just a dropout in the link, or do you think they cottoned on to the fact this is an Australian journalist?
Yeah, that's right. You know, they cottoned on to the fact. I remember the tension in the communication. I think, you know, look, we've been sprung. And as we later found out, you know, the Uvea, that pretty little yacht, went to the bottom of the Pacific Ocean. I'd love to know what was happening out there.
Chris's next move is to Paris to find evidence to prove this is a French Secret Service operation. He arrives in the middle of a political and media tornado.
When I was there, I walked into this scrum. It was like the French Watergate. The defence minister's tenure was in big question. The local media were just getting onto it, and I probably had more information about what occurred than any other journalist in the world. I was suddenly a person of interest. I would come back to my one-star hotel and find a massive scrum of people outside, you know, all wanting to kind of trade information with me.
Chris shares some of his goods from his time in New Zealand with a leading French investigative reporter, who in return introduces him to insiders at the DGSE, France's Secret Service.
But he did put me in touch with this fellow. This fellow actually gave me names as well of who the various crews were. You know, it wasn't just Pierre and Mafar, but there were others, the demolition crew, etc. I was told that the comrades back in Paris were pretty unhappy about Mafar and Pierre being locked up in a jail and having to take the blame for all this.
After weeks on the road, Chris returns to Australia with an incredible story and a nervous wait until it goes to air.
It's a real worry for investigative journalists that the longer you take, the more footprints you leave, and other people get onto what you're doing and they go to the same witnesses and they say, tell me what you told Four Corners. And so it's so exasperating. And, you know, my lead time was such that I wasn't going to get to air for a couple of weeks. Could I hang on to this stuff, or was it going to be scooped?
What Chris didn't know at the time is that he'd been in a race with Bernard Tricot to produce a definitive version of events.
Première révélation du rapport Tricot, des agents secrets français se trouvaient bien en Nouvelle-Zélande. Ils sont au nombre de 7, leur mission uniquement du renseignement. Tout d'abord, les faux époux Sophie et Alain Thuringe, tous deux étaient chargés d'une mission, collecter des informations sur la campagne du Rainbow Warrior.
On August 26, 1985, Bernard Tricot released his report into the Rainbow Warrior affair. It confirmed France had indeed sent DGSE agents to New Zealand. But Tricot's report claimed they were only monitoring Greenpeace to learn about the group's plans for upcoming anti-nuclear protests. Apparently, they had no orders to attack the Rainbow Warrior, and Tricot said he found no evidence to suggest the agents went rogue with an unauthorised operation. His report had the desired effect. The New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Times in London all ran stories about the DGSE's exoneration. On the same day, Chris Masters aired his docudrama, French Connections, on Four Corners.
This week, the Rainbow Warrior revisited. France has second thoughts about sinking the truth. Hello, thanks for joining me for this special edition of Four Corners, Chris Masters' much-acclaimed docudrama on the sinking of the Rainbow Warrior.
It's an extraordinary piece of work, blending on-the-spot recordings with dramatic reenactments. While Tricot's report attempted to put distance between the Rainbow Warrior affair and Mitterrand, Chris's report took the scandal to the steps of the LSA Palace. And then, within just a few weeks, France's most respected newspaper, Le Monde, would drop a report that would cause all hell to break loose at the highest levels of the French government. Detective Maurice Witham.
They had information that we couldn't even imagine getting. There was some unbelievable stuff came out.
China promoting its military movements, releasing this vision of its advances around Australia's coast, showing off its sea and air defence exercises.
While I was on Norfolk Island, a Chinese warship was firing live ammunition in the nearby Tasman Sea. Because it was happening pretty close to Norfolk, it was a hot topic on the island. There was conjecture in the media about how much the Australian government knew about it.
The Chief of Defence has confirmed there was no prior warning.
Is it the case that Defence was only notified via Virgin and Air Services Australia 28 minutes after the firing window commenced?
Yes.
It got me thinking about Australia's place in a rapidly changing world and the role we've played and will continue to play in the Pacific region. How do our Pacific neighbours see us?
Well, I think they look upon Australia with a bit of suspicion.
I think New Zealand being the good cop to Australia's bad cop.
There's a view that we've long used our influence in the region to act as America's deputy sheriff.
It was delegated the job of keeping New Zealand in line.
Australia has become really has been sucked into the whole nuclear weapons strategy in the region.
In trying to work out whether it was a cock-up, a conspiracy, or something in between that allowed the French agents to leave Norfolk Island, I decided I had to learn a bit more about Australia's attitude towards nuclear weapons in the region at the time. Normally, Aussies and Kiwis are on the same page with most things. But in the mid-80s, nukes had caused a foreign policy rift between the countries. New Zealand had taken a principled stance to block US warships carrying nuclear weapons from its ports. Australia hadn't. I tracked down Marco Dijon, a young Pacific historian and lecturer at Auckland University of Technology. Marco has ancestral ties to Samoa. Like me, he's a National Archives nerd. When we spoke, Marco was excited because he'd recently unearthed a declassified document from the 1980s that helps explain Australia's nuanced position on nuclear weapons and its attitude towards smaller Pacific nations.
This is a shocking document.
It gives a rare insight into how Australia tried to have its cake and eat it too when it came to the presence of US nuclear weapons in the region.
There's a thick contradiction between the Australian Labor Party's domestic support for anti-nuclearism, because at the same time in the region, they were seeking to undercut anti-nuclear sentiment and preserve American strategic interests.
At the 1983 South Pacific Forum in Canberra, the newly elected Hawke government tabled a proposal for a regional nuclear-free zone. But there was one catch. Nuclear-armed US ships and subs still had to be allowed to transit through. The declassified document Marco's got his hands on is a masterclass in the real politic of how Australia balances domestic politics, regional relationships, and national security. Marco read some of it to me.
Australia is committed to advancing the concept of a South Pacific nuclear free zone. Australia cannot retreat from this commitment. At the same time, nuclear issues are live issues in the South Pacific for a variety of reasons in Moruroa Atoll. Pacific Island nuclear concerns are linked with the role of the oceans in their traditions and cultures, and as a resource. Pacific Islanders, in principle, draw no real distinction between Japanese proposals to dump waste material in the northern Pacific, US proposals to sink obsolete nuclear submarines off California, and the testing of nuclear weapons at Mururoa Atoll. It is all the Pacific Ocean, our ocean.
I like that last sentence. Unusually spiritual for a foreign affairs hardhead.
Most, however, are realistic enough to appreciate the principles of deterrence and the security provided by the ANZUS umbrella, although the majority would not want this to be publicly affirmed. But there are one or two ideologues, and one or two, because of their colonial experiences, lacking sophistication, who could develop proposals related to a nuclear-free South Pacific, which could pose real problems for ANZUS partners.
Frank, yet condescending.
One important objective of Australia is to preempt such proposals of a more radical or impractical nature. Ours is a process of damage containment.
Damage containment. For who? The Americans? On September 18, 1985, Paris newspaper Le Monde blew up a giant attempt at damage containment with a massive scoop.
The involvement of a section of the French intelligence service is now dominating French radio, television,
respected
and newspapers.
French newspaper Le Monde claims two French army frogmen blew up the ship and escaped by plane on the minister's direct
the
orders.
The finger points very straight at one branch of the secret services called the DGSE.
The French government is, of course, involved.
Reporter Edwy Planel filed a story quoting sources from France's intelligence agency, the DGSE, accusing the country's defence minister, Charles Ernoux, of authorising the attack. Planel also revealed the existence of a third team of DGSE agents who attached the Limpet mines to the hull of the Rainbow Warrior. These agents had escaped New Zealand and were not known to Kiwi police.
The Rainbow Warrior was sunken by a third team of French military. It was the missing link.
That's Planel in a TVNZ Sunday program report in 2005. Planel's story completely contradicted the findings of Bernard Tricot's official investigation, which just a few weeks earlier had cleared France of any involvement. Tricot had only mentioned two teams of agents, the fake married couple and our friends on the Uvea. According to Tricot, they were sent to New Zealand only to monitor Greenpeace's activities, not to sabotage them. Tricot's work had been exposed as a whitewash. French President François Mitterrand was facing a crisis, his very own underwater gate. Here's David Longy, New Zealand's PM at the time of the bombing, reflecting on Mitterrand's level of complicity.
I think that he will carry to his grave the secret as to whether he knew about the mission to sink the Warrior. I have no evidence that he knew. I am certain that he knew afterwards, and long before France admitted to it.
Planel, who was in his early 30s when he dropped this extraordinary scoop, and today still remains one of France's top journalists, couldn't believe the stupidity of his own government.
Why did they continue to lie when it was revealed very early on that the Taranges were the French agents Maffar and Prieur? Why did they continue to lie when we knew that the Uvea carried agents from the DGSE? Still, they kept on lying.
Like American journalist hero Bob Woodward of Watergate fame, Planel had his own deep throat for his Rainbow Warrior stories. He called his secret source Le Consul. Unlike Woodward and Deep Throat, who we now know as former FBI Deputy Director Mark Felt, Planel and Le Consul didn't meet in dark parking lots. That's not the French style. They met in some of Paris's finest restaurants. Hopefully Le Monde had a generous expense account.
The fallout was amazing.
That's what Maurice Witham remembers of the impact of Planel's work. Planel again.
We publish our information on the Tuesday, and Charles Ernoux and Amiral Lacoste dismiss on the Friday. 3 days. The truth is that France organized this bombing and must apologize to New Zealand.
Although the head of the DGSE, Admiral Lacoste, and Defence Minister Ernoux were gone, Mitterrand continued to deny any knowledge of the plot. Few believed him. Former New Zealand detective Chris Martin.
Nobody goes up and blows up a ship in a foreign country and the president isn't well aware of what's going on.
40 years on, Chris is still in awe at the work of Planel and his colleagues.
It was those journalists in France, Le Monde, that really put the whole thing together. Those French journalists just being relentless.
On September 22, 1985, the French Prime Minister, Laurent Fabius, gave a televised address confirming French agents had bombed the Rainbow Warrior and that they acted on orders.
Des premières conclusions de l'enquête menée sur l'affaire du Rainbow Warrior. J'ai tenu à vous les faire connaître immédiatement.
Defence Minister Ernoux died in 1990. A few years later, he was revealed to have been a paid informant for the Soviet bloc intelligence agencies in the 1950s and 60s, leaving him vulnerable to blackmail during his tenure as defence minister. Le Monde broke another huge story in 2005 about Mitterrand, who'd passed years earlier. They published a secret document in which the DGSE boss, Admiral Lacoste, testified he'd been personally authorised by the president to sink the Rainbow Warrior. It also emerged that Mitterrand was so paranoid about Planel that he ordered an illegal phone-tapping operation against him in 1985 in an attempt to uncover his sources. A few weeks after Planel's explosive 1985 reports came out, Mitterrand did the one thing he could to remind everyone of his power. He authorised 4 nuclear weapons tests at Mururoa Atoll, his way of flipping the bird to the world. Next time on Fallout, Spies on Norfolk Island.
It was very easy to ask around, and everybody was talking about it, of course. I had tried to contact the administrator and got stonewalled.
All this evidence, 181 witnesses, all the statements were prepared, ready to go to court to hear the case.
So it's launch day of episode one, Fallout Spies on Norfolk Island, and I'm actually on the road again in country New South Wales.